Blog Talk Radio.
United. We got a great show planned for you this evening. Heather Langenkamp from A Nightmare on Elm Street. She's cemented her place in the history of the horror genre firmly with that movie, one of the most beloved classics of the horror genre in the past 30 years.
Yeah.
How are you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right. I think I couldn't have said it better myself. I think that you really summed it up, and I was just thinking as you were saying that, that's something we don't have today in mainstream movies with the reboots or the remakes. Or we don't have any Scream Queens.
That's true.
We have
and we don't have, we don't really
right.
have,
yeah.
We don't really have great horror movie villains anymore either.
No. Well, we have
There's something about the
80s.
Yeah,
yeah
we, well,
right.
maybe
you're
that's
right.
it.
No, you're absolutely
maybe
right,
that's
though.
It.
We really
but
don't.
But the 80s brought about, you know, a lot of the majors and the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't have Leatherface, Jason, Freddy, Mike Myers. I mean, he's doing another Austin Powers, Mike Myers. But the character.
You know, I know. I was thinking today earlier, I would love, instead of another Austin Powers, another Wayne's World, but I know that's never going to happen. I know that's wishful thinking on my part, but.
Possibly, but you don't know how desperate they might get.
They could always get really desperate.
I mean, I could see it being an act of desperation.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
but
hey,
you're right,
you know
though,
what?
About the villains. You're absolutely right.
Thank you. Thank you. I think so. What is that? I mean, I don't... Because the Saw thing, whatever the Saw villain, the whatever the puppet thing...
No, well, let me get into that, because I've unfortunately seen all of them, and I did not go see the last Final Destination movie, because I just felt, you know what, you know, as you get older, you realize, do you really need to see this? Is this going to help your life or whatever? And I'm like, no, this is not going to help me. I don't think I need to see this before I go to my grave. But no, going back to Saul, though, they, like, went back and forth. They kept changing it, you know, and, you know, you at times you felt sorry for him, the character, Jigsaw or whatever, whoever, and at times you hate it. I'm just like, I don't care. Nuke the city or whatever. I don't give, I really don't care.
Well, yeah, it got pretty old. I think everybody involved knew it did. However, the new Paranormal Activity, the trailer for that's out, and I don't know why I didn't realize that that's what they're going to do with the plot. I mean, it's obvious. They're telling the story of them as children.
Yeah, Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now the problem is this going to be the same kind of gimmick, or is it going to play more like a narrative film? I don't know.
I have no idea. I've only seen the trailer, so I don't honestly know.
Because I don't know if they had, you know, video camera surveillance like that when those two characters were little girls.
Yeah, what? So when would that be exactly? Are we thinking like the late 80s or something? Or
early 90s something? But even
then,
I mean,
that would be, that makes sense. But
there wasn't the proliferation of that kind of technology back then.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody was holding like 50-pound camcorders.
That's true. But I'm amazed it got three movies out of it, to be honest with you. That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, I guess it is. Hey, we got some breaking news. It's not really breaking. I just like to play this music.
Wow, okay, so now I'm really curious. What is the breaking news?
Oh, everybody knows what it is. It's somewhat movie-related, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
The West Memphis Three being freed.
Oh, yeah, well, definitely. That's awesome.
Yeah, I suppose it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is one of the great documentaries, Paradise Lost.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great documentary because you feel kind of life unfurling right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of documentaries, they recap events through, you know, present-day testimonies and that kind of thing. This, everything's happening as it's happening in front of the camera, you know, as they're shooting
right.
it. And there's a special life to that and an excitement. It's a jaw-dropping movie of at least three teens that were convicted of murdering these three little boys, right, in a very gruesome way. In spite of there being no physical evidence linking them
right.
to the crime. And so it's been, for the past 18 or so years, it's been a big movement
mm-hmm.
to right this injustice. I don't quite know that they've done that with this verdict. But here's how CBS News reported the story.
My name is Damian Echols. I'm 36 years old and released today from death row for a crime I did not commit.
Arkansas death row inmate Damian Echols got his life back today. As part of an unusual plea agreement, Echols and two other convicted men, Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly, were released from prison.
You know, this has been going on for over 18 years, and it's been an absolute living hell.
17 years ago, Damian Echols was sentenced to death. The other two were given life. Jason Baldwin.
In the beginning, we told nothing but the truth that we were innocent, and they sent us to prison for the rest of our lives for it.
Three teenagers were taken into custody.
Known as the West Memphis Three, the men were teenagers in 1994 when they were convicted of killing 3 8-year-old boys in the town of West Memphis, Arkansas. Stevie Branch, Christopher Byers, and Michael Moore. Investigators in this rural community believe that the teenagers killed the children as part of a satanic ritual. In recent years, though, DNA evidence has been recovered at the scene, none of it linking the accused to the crime. Their freedom comes at a high price. Under the unusual agreement known as an Alford plea, the three men who still say they are innocent had to plead guilty to murder.
And the only thing that the state would do for us was to say, hey, we'll let you go, only if you admit guilt. And that's not justice, no matter how you look at it.
While the father of one of the victims voiced his support for the three men,
you know, I'm glad that they're free.
Sir, would you have a seat, please?
Another had to be removed from the court after objecting to the deal.
This was not justice.
A deal that almost didn't happen. Jason Baldwin, who didn't initially want to make the plea, finally agreed to get Damian Echols off death row.
I did not want to take the deal from the get-go. However, they're trying to kill Damian then.
All right, so the plea agreement was that they... And these incidents are in no small part due to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
They made two movies. They've made a third one.
That's right.
The Berlinger, Joe Berlinger is one of the co-directors of it. The third one, they were going to premiere in Toronto very soon, and then
mm-hmm.
this happened, and so they rushed back to film their new ending.
Mm-hmm.
But they say that they'll be ready in time for the New York Film Festival with a new ending.
Wow. Okay.
But, the plea agreement is... They essentially have to admit that they're guilty in order to get out, which is what they did.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So that sucks. And you know why? I mean, they don't want wrongful imprisonment lawsuit
right,
filed
of course.
Against them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's crummy. We'll never find out who really did this. I mean, somebody got away with it.
No, someone did get away with this. And I remember when this story broke on the I was watching the local news, and when this story first came up, and there was already so much outrage over it. I mean, but It is amazing, though. I never thought I'd see this happen, but it's not the way I would have done it. I mean, but they are out.
Yeah. Well, the third documentary, they've released a trailer for that, and there's one area of the trailer here that I'm going to play.
Okay, yeah, please do.
How you doing?
We were talking about that in the car. Ten years.
10 years.
It's been a long time.
I really do believe these people would have gotten away with murdering me if it would not have been for what you guys did. For being there in the very beginning and getting this whole thing on tape so that the rest of the world sees what was happening. If not for that, these people would have murdered me, swept this under the rug, and I wouldn't be anything but a memory right now.
Yeah, so Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory is the name of their third film. And when we send Dean up to the New York Film Festival, maybe he can get into that and give us a report on it.
Well, that would be great.
Berlinger, what else did he make? He made Crude not too long ago.
Yeah,
the oil
I haven't
movie.
Seen Crude yet.
Didn't he make Brothers Keeper? Was he the director of that one?
Let me double check for you.
I think he was. I think that's what really catapulted him was Brothers Keeper. Do you ever see Brothers Keeper?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a very important film. All these films is really funny. Or like really have like. Let me see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. He did the Paradise. Metallica is some kind of monster, which is
right.
A good documentary. He also did the Blair Witch.
Yes.
Two, Book of
that
Shadows.
Was his that was his
I
narrative.
On my resume, but yeah.
Right.
But otherwise, though, no, Crude was the most recent thing. I thought there was something else, though, but maybe that's what I was thinking of, the Blair Witch sequel. But the Paradise Lost things are incredible. I still haven't seen Crude, but that's supposed to be very good, too.
Yeah, Paradise Lost premiered on HBO, I think,
mm-hmm.
something
that's
like
right.
96 it came
96,
out.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't remember much about the second one.
The second one focused on... I want to
the
say
father, right?
The father, and it really portrays him out to be quite a monster, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Well, that's the jaw-dropping moment in the first film when
mm-hmm.
when the blood on the knife matches the father's
right.
DNA. Yeah, that was holy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Holy hell! What
mm-hmm.
am I watching?
Exactly.
Anyway. I wanted to tell everyone out there at the top of the show, since I normally do it at the beginning of the end of the show, you can join our Facebook fan page, Movie Geeks United, on Facebook. Please do, for the latest updates on the show and guest bookings and so forth. We're also on Twitter, where you can follow us there at Movie Geeks Unite. You could drop us an email if you'd like to at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. Or visit our official website at moviegeeksunited.net for a complete archive of more than 600 filmmaker interviews, featured shows, and the latest updates on the Kubrick series, which will close in March of next year. So there's plenty of time to go to the website.
Yeah, you got lots of time. A lot of time, folks. A lot of time.
Yeah. Okay, do you want to get to our guest?
Yeah, let's get to our guest.
All right, Heather Langenkamp. This was 1984, Nightmare on Elm Street. Premiered, right? So
that's
it's
right.
Been,
yeah, I think yeah,
yes.
I think you're right.
17 years ago, what a phenomenon that it's become. Many films later, they've already rebooted it, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's really made a mark on the pop culture, and that includes Heather herself and her role as Nancy in the film. She has made a new documentary called I Am Nancy, that kind of chronicles and explores that phenomenon and her place in it. It's available now at Amazon.com, and you can also purchase it from her website at IamNancy.net. Here is Heather.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
We just see cuts happen.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Tina!
The coroner got to say. It's in the had John puking since he saw it.
They're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy? There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
No!
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails...
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive.
Help me!
I guess, first of all, let's start with your reasoning for wanting to make this documentary.
Well, I actually was kind of goaded into it by my sister-in-law, who really had been wanting to make, you know, make a film, and she wanted to get more involved in directing and editing herself. And we were working together on a job for my makeup effects studio, and she was really kind of interested by the way that all of the, several of the employees, not all of them, but a lot of them were really big Freddy fans and had Freddy tattoos and belt buckles and t-shirts and all sorts of, like, just, you know, Freddy nuts, basically. And she thought, well, that's interesting. I didn't know this movie was so popular. And she was coming from a completely kind of outside point of view, and I said, oh, yeah, no, this movie is really popular, and people are really devoted to Freddy, and then she said, well, what about you? You know, you were the star of that movie, and I'm like, well, but, you know, not so much Nancy, not, you know, there's not that many Nancy fans, really, in the way that they love Freddy and collect the toys and all of that, and so she was like, well, that's not right, and so from there, she kept developing this idea that it was high time to kind of put a spotlight on Nancy and use me as a way of doing that. And just by kind of having a tongue-in-cheek, you know, question that we asked, you know, why Freddy Mania and not Nancy Mania? And so that's where we started, and that's how we ended up taking a camera crew to the first convention, and that's the question that we would ask people.
Mm-hmm. It's funny to me with documentaries especially that you set out to make one and you have a goal in mind. As you said, that original question about why not Nancy. But in the course of making a documentary, it can become something else. What about the process surprised you the most?
Well, like from the very get-go, we started meeting fans who were, you know, really serious about their love of the movie that was a lot deeper than just kind of that typical fandom that you think about where, you know, you just really love horror movies or being scared. That we just really sensed that there was something about this particular movie that resonated with people who, you know, had certain kinds of lives, who had certain kinds of struggles in their life, and who really made the connection between themselves and Nancy. And they kind of aligned themselves with her kind of thinking in that survival mode and getting through this, you know, very devastating part of their life that was trying to kill them. And I found a lot of people were literally identifying themselves with Nancy, which I thought was, you know, very interesting and kind of hard to believe, actually, in the beginning. So we pursued that with several of the fans, and we got these really great stories about, you know, just how hard life is for a teenager, especially, you know, some teenagers just have really pretty tough lives to deal with, and over all ranges of things, you know. And I realized that I started getting really empathetic with the kinds of stories that they were telling me because I just felt like, wow, this is their way of coping. This is the way they coped and the way they got through this part of their life that they, you know, didn't really enjoy very much. And it was kind of a theme that I kept hearing over and over again is that, you know, there was a lot going on in lives that they were trying to kind of escape from, avoid, and surmount. And I'll just add one more thing, is that we really tried to avoid, like, that really over-serious tone. So we tried to cut it up and use the editing and the music and a lot of the funny things that we see on the convention floor to kind of just, like, slice through a lot of that more, you know, serious part and try to match him side by side.
But that was the first time that you were made aware of kind of the depth of the influence of your character.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had had inklings of it from going to conventions for, whatever, 20 years now, but it just seems more and more that I'm seeing more of that and amongst the fans and this willingness to kind of tell me these kinds of stories. In the past, people weren't quite so forthcoming.
Who's Nancy?
It was just a horror movie, and I had never seen a horror movie before. I didn't know it at the time, but it would change my life.
I'm kind of on a quest to really understand, you know, what this is all about.
I think you have to really go to the real fans and see what Nancy, you know, means to people, because she's such an important character and she's such an important part of the story. It's not just Freddy.
So how did you define, when you nabbed the role of Nancy in Nightmare on Elm Street, how did you go about defining that character for yourself?
Well, I mean, it was really clear that she was going to have to be this really sensible, ingenious kind of fighter. And, you know, it wasn't something that I set about doing with a lot of, you know, kind of that actor method preparation. I just really felt like if I played each moment as realistically as possible in this very fantastic setting, that alone was going to set her apart as being, you know, able to kind of keep control of herself and be this kind of very special, you know, teenage girl. It didn't have to take much. It didn't really take much at all to just be as understated as possible.
Well, what strikes me about it is that, I mean, the film, the people behind the film were very passionate, an accomplished group of people behind the movie. But it was a lower budget affair. No one could have expected it to become the phenomenon that it did. Tell me about the atmosphere on the set. And you guys were young. Did it have this kind of air of innocence about it, or?
You know, there was just gosh, it's hard to put a word on it. It was a workaday environment. I mean, there wasn't, with this extra ingredient of, you know, making horror movies, which involves kind of, it's like a magician with a big toolbox there who is going to pull out certain things in hopes that they work. I mean, nothing was proven or had been tried before. So every time we tried something, we knew it could have, you know, succeeded or failed. And everyone is really patient, and, you know, if it hadn't worked, they would have somehow made do anyway. There were no expectations that it had to be great or that we had to do anything special. In fact, since there were no expectations, I think it gave everyone a lot of, it was just much more relaxed. I can imagine if there were tons of expectations, you know, everyone would have been a lot more nervous about the way they were performing and what they were going to bring to the set each day. But, you know, Wes was very calm, and everyone was really quiet. We had, you know, pretty, you know, long hours, and everyone was working hard. But, like I said, there was a feeling of, like, going to work every day and just getting that work done. And as a result, I think people just were very real. I mean, everybody was kind of real to who they were.
And when were you first aware that it had become a phenomenon?
Well, I think, like, the first time I heard there were horror movie conventions, I think it's when I was like, really? it was probably about 4 or 5 years later. And you know, even after Nightmare 3, it wasn't that popular in my circle. I mean, nobody really ever talked about it. So to me, it was kind of the sleeping giant. And then as I started being invited to more of these events and I saw the actual fans who were, you know, spending their hard-earned money to go, I was like, wow, this is much more of a culture than I ever thought it was. And, you know, then all of the internet gets invented and then all of these sites and all these radio programs and so many people are, you know, kind of making a second living off of this, you know, this world of horror. And, yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, you talk about it being a culture unto itself, and I find that horror movie fans are among the most loyal you'll find on the planet. And you've attended conventions and met with fans over the years. Tell me about that interaction in general. What do you get from them?
Yeah, and the loyalty is just—it's you can't even really explain it to somebody. You have to have them come with you. And, like, really see it for themselves. But I guess it stems from, you know, when you first see a horror movie and you're young, it does so much, it sends you to, like, this new kind of planet of experience of being afraid and frightened and screaming and the thrill and all of that. I think that it also forms a deep bond with people to really love it. If they love that experience, then they end up loving it forever. If they hated that experience, then, you know, they don't later become fans. I think it's something that really, you're either you love it or you don't. And it kind of, you can split the world down the middle. I have yet to find a friend who didn't like horror who I've convinced to like it. You know, it's almost, it's something that you either... that you passionately believe in or that you just passionately avoid.
Well,
and that's
kind
of how the fans are.
Right, and it taps in, Nightmare on Elm Street taps in on something so universal, and those are the horror movies that I find that really last. I mean, we all sleep, we all dream. It's like The Shower in Psycho and The Shark in Jaws. I mean, it's a kind of inescapable. It's part of our everyday life, so it taps into that. I would imagine that fans are rabid for your movie. Have you had screenings of it? I know it's available on DVD through Amazon and at IamNancy.net. Have you screened it for fans as well?
I've screened it at several cities. You know, I've Phoenix, San Francisco, Los Angeles, you know, some of the bigger cities. I'm going to Denver next month. So I do screenings, but mainly, and I go to these conventions where I usually screen it, but most of the people who want to see it buy it either on Amazon or from my website. And it's been on sale since May, and it's doing really well. I mean, I'm really amazed at how many people are interested in seeing it. But getting the word out, you know, it's tough. It's you know, every day someone says, I had no idea that you had put this out yet. So I realize that my work is actually still to be done and letting everybody know that it's out.
Would you mind it if I just asked you a couple of listener questions? They were so excited that you were coming on the show. Lucas wanted to know, he saw the film. He wanted to know, was Heather suggesting that there will be another Nightmare project with Wes at the end of I Am Nancy?
Oh, that's funny. I don't think so, but I do think that Wes gave me such a great interview, and it's almost worth the whole movie itself is some of the things that he tells us about his inspiration for writing Nightmare on Elm Street. But I don't think so. I think Wes is pretty much done with Nightmare on Elm Street. Unfortunately, I mean, wouldn't it be great if he was able to somehow come back? But, you know, he has a career that I think I don't know if he's, like, it's a priority for him to go back and revisit that whole world. And now that Warner Brothers is kind of doing it in their own way, I don't know if there would be a place for him. But I do think that he was very sincere when he said those nice things about me. I mean, I really feel so flattered in the comments that he made.
And what sets him apart, in your view, among the directors that you've worked with?
Well, I mean, he's just really committed to, he's so committed to his art form, which, you know, it's genre films and horror movies, in a way that very few filmmakers I get an opportunity to be committed. You know, I mean, a lot of, you know, a director who wants to just do comedy, you know, works on it their whole career and tries to perfect it and tries to find, you know, new things in it all the time and please his audience. And Wes is very much like that. You know, I think he is always trying to discover more for himself and for his audience, like what is fear, what does scare people, what are the mm-hmm. stories that we could, you know, gather around the campfire and listen to and be scared by. And, you know, some people are like, oh, you know, this one wasn't scary or this one wasn't a success financially. But, you know, in our movie making world, there's a million reasons why a movie cannot be financially successful. And it's not necessarily that the movie's no good. I mean, and I would certainly say that about Nightmare 7, which is probably my favorite. You know, I think that movie's mm-hmm. excellent. And we won the Toronto Film Festival and we got a lot of praise for that movie. But in general, it was kind of, you know, it wasn't a financially successful film. So, you know, he's always looking after his passion, which is, you know, which is horror. And I think he's going to be remembered as somebody who, you know, really was committed to that whole genre and built it into something that now is, you know, considered extremely mainstream.
Yeah. You know, but you talked about there being no expectations with the first one, so it had kind of a workaday atmosphere. But by the time you get to New Nightmare, obviously the series has become the phenomenon. Did it feel different? Was it a different atmosphere?
It was a much different atmosphere, and I do think that there was a lot more kind of pressure to provide something that people wanted to see, or, you know, there was an expectation that, you know, that Freddy had to be a certain amount of scariness and Nancy had to have this particular kind of strength, and they had to battle in a way that had, you know, been preordained kind of by the previous movies that we had done. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of talking about how we had done it in the past and how do we, you know, how are we going to meet now? We did it this way back then. And, you know, what parallels can we draw to the first? How can we make them really cool for the audience to enjoy? And it's like when I'm sitting there with my kid and we're watching, and he's watching Nightmare on Elm Street, like those kinds of things, these so informed the script. They also informed how we were performing as well, I think. I mean, maybe Robert mm-hmm. would disagree with me, but I think that I was always thinking about Nancy number one, you know, when I was being Nancy in that movie.
Right. Last question. Elizabeth, she wants you to know that she loves you, first of all. And,
thank you.
She wants to know, she says, I always wondered what Heather thought of working with both Johnny Depp and Patricia Arquette at the beginning of their careers. Did she have a sense of their special, unique kind of talents and where they were going to go with their careers?
Well, I have to say, so many of the actors that were in those movies were, you know, just as talented. I mean, I look at Larry Fishburne and, you know, gosh, Nan Martin and all the people that I've had the privilege, Amanda Wiss, and they were all so good at what they do. And, you know, whether somebody becomes a superstar or not, you know so many people who are such fine actors, the ones that become superstars, you're like, yeah, it was evident there, but it's evident in so many people that you work with. Why it happens to certain people and not others is, it's something that's so mysterious, and it's probably like the most alluring part of the entertainment business is trying to figure that out. And
mm-hmm.
but certainly, I mean, both Johnny and Patricia, they're pretty magical people in and of themselves. I mean, just if you met them on the street, they're really super unique.
Well, this series has been in your life for so many years now. With I Am Nancy, do you feel like you've kind of come full circle and closed a chapter on it in a way?
You know, I totally do. I feel like I've really, like what I really wanted to do is just, I wanted to kind of put a big bow on this whole 25 years and say how great it was for me and what an honor it was for me to be part of that whole thing and do my part to memorialize this character that Wes Craven created. And I wanted to, you know, kind of shout out to the world that Wes was such a genius and Robert Englund is such a genius too. And so I really feel like I accomplished it with I Am Nancy. I did everything I set out to do and actually a little bit more. I hope I tell a story that inspires people in and of themselves just who, you know, watch the movie and might feel better about some of the trials and bad stuff that they have to live through every day. So there's this kind of like, you know, inspirational message that I was able to fit in as well. So, I mean, I kind of was amazed when I saw the final product and was able to really step back and appreciate it, that I did accomplish what I wanted, and I don't have to be worried that, you know, Nancy's going to be forgotten or that the whole Nightmare on Elm Street phenomenon, I wasn't able to make a comment about it. Because, you know, often people who participate in these big phenomenons, you never really hear what they think about it. You know, you don't really know what Harrison Ford thinks about the whole Star Wars thing, even though he's such an important part of it. But I'm sure he has some pretty cool opinions about why it was such an important film. And I'm interested in that, you know. The actors are a really integral part of movies. And so I felt, whether people, you know, agree or not, but I just really felt that there was something that I could add to the conversation that hadn't already been said.
Well, there's obviously a lot of love out there for Nightmare on Elm Street and a lot of love out there for you. I mean, I've been bombarded with emails once we announced that you were going to be on the show. So we all love you, and thank you so much for making I Am Nancy. I mean, it's a big treat for any fan of this series and of you. And
oh, well, thank you. Yeah, IamNancy.net, you can get it there, and I'll autograph it. And then you can come to a convention where I usually have them on my table, or, you know, you can go to Amazon.com.
So tell me what upcoming conventions, where people can see you in person.
Okay, I'm going to be in Denver on September 26th, and then I'll be in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, the first week in October. And then I'm going to, Rock and Shock in Massachusetts on the 7th and 8th of September, I believe. The 15th and 16th of September at Rock and Shock, Massachusetts. That's in Worcester. And then, that's what the schedule is now. And at IamNancy.net, I usually put up all my engagements so people can follow where I'll be from there.
Well, you're busy. You're traveling all over the place.
I'm busy. I'm traveling. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go to Tulsa, which is my hometown, at some point this fall. I don't know what day, but we're going to show it there at the Circle Theater. And so, yeah, it's a full-time job.
Okay, that is Heather Langenkamp. Her movie is I Am Nancy. It's a documentary about the Nightmare on Elm Street phenomenon, and it is now available on DVD. You can go to Amazon.com, or you can purchase it at IamNancy.net. And she's making tons of appearances at various horror conventions across the country. She's even going to Australia in November, so those out there that are listening in Australia, you know, we don't know who's out there listening and where they're listening. It's always amazing. So,
it is, but we do have a lot of people in Australia who like us. So
yeah. I mean, we get emails like all the time from these strange places. I mean, not strange places. I'm not criticizing our loyal listeners out there. You don't live in a strange place.
Mm-hmm.
From all over. That's what I mean. So she was a sweetheart, and it was have her on the show. I wanted to talk to you about Ridley Scott.
Yeah, this is interesting. Why don't you tell in case people don't know what it is, say what's
going
on.
Well, he's currently shooting Prometheus,
mm-hmm.
which is a takeoff on section of his film Alien.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's almost like how they inhabited that planet
right
prior to Alien.
Mm-hmm.
That's the gist I'm getting from it.
Okay.
And now he just announced that he's going to do another Blade Runner, but it will not be a remake.
Okay.
So I would imagine a continuation of that story.
This is interesting because this has been going, they've been talking about this for a long time. This really wasn't a shock. Now, it would have been a shock if it was a reboot or a remake, but they have been talking about a sequel since the late 90s when K.W. Jeter wrote those sequels, a couple of sequels to Blade Runner. I don't know if they're going to be based on that. I'm really not sure. But now this is the question. Is Harrison Ford coming back, or that's out of the equation completely?
You know, I would think not, because I think Harrison Ford is a bit soured on that whole experience.
What isn't he soured on? I mean,
that's the permanent scowl on his face. I mean,
yeah.
He's soured about something. But he never... It just wasn't his material. And I would venture to think it could easily work, that first Blade Runner, with someone else in the lead, too.
Mm-hmm.
Not anyone else, but someone else. I'm sure there are other actors that could have made it just as good, if not better,
right,
performance-wise. But
right.
he always thought that the film needed a beating heart, someone that the audience could sympathize with, so he completely rejected the notion that he himself was an android.
I can see that. I like the original theatrical cut. I think the voiceover narration, everything is wonderful. I mean, yeah, the other versions are good, but I really love the original theatrical cut.
And he hated the narration too, Harrison Ford.
Well, I don't think Harrison Ford has a pot to piss in right now. He was in Cowboys and Aliens, so he should just shut the fuck up. He should and in Crystal Skull and Hollywood Homicide. So. And now he badmouths everything he's in. But
right.
So I don't think he really is one to really say anything about that. Blade Runner is actually a very good movie, a very hard movie the first time you watch it, but on especially if you're 11 or 12 years old. But it's a fantastic film. I mean, Philip K. Dick liked it, and he had seen a cut before he passed away. And it is a different book. I mean, a different movie from the book, but it's a really fascinating film, and it set the stage. I mean, not so much, I mean, movies definitely, but culturally, it really,
yeah.
If you watch Beautiful, the Javier Bardem movie, the city in that, the slums look no different than the Los Angeles that is presented in Blade Runner. Blade Runner is sort of like the precursor to globalization. I mean, it's a fascinating movie. It's just absolutely fascinating. I always said that the future would be one of two movies, Soylent Green or Blade Runner. I think it's going to be Blade Runner. I don't think it's going to be Soylent Green. Well, I hope it's not going to be Soylent Green, but but I think that's the future. It always came down to those two movies. Which
yes.
will it be? And I think it's going to be Blade Runner. That's what it looks like right now.
Look, I think Blade Runner is a classic movie, but it's in that category of movies for me that I admire more than I enjoy
mm-hmm.
watching. Because, I mean, it's impossible not to admire its vision.
Mm-hmm. It's a cold movie.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a cold film.
And I've made sense of that for myself
mm-hmm.
because Harrison Ford's right in that there really is no beating heart in the movie, but it feels like the movie itself is almost a replicant of a feeling movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So thematically, I think it's the right way to go. It's just not the kind of movie that I will sit and enjoy and be as involved in as something else that I could feel something for.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's just the nature of the movie and, mm-hmm. and my taste in movies.
Right.
What's interesting to me is the fact that Ridley Scott, regardless of what anyone thinks of him,
mm-hmm.
his two greatest movies, his two greatest towering achievements in his career are Alien and Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
He's made great movies outside of those.
But those are
the
two that really stand
tentacles.
Out.
Yeah. So in this last act of his career, somebody that's kind of thrived on doing many different kinds of movies,
mm-hmm.
Someone to Watch Over Me, Thelma and Louise, Matchstick Men, Gladiator, Hannibal,
mm-hmm.
it seems odd that he's returning to his two greatest hits. It's almost, I made a comment that it almost felt like a lounge singer that relies on his greatest hits to get applause. You know, he feeds off of that. And Chris said, you know, like Barry Manilow. And I said, yes, exactly like Barry Manilow. But there's something intrinsically different between a musician and a filmmaker. Filmmakers normally don't do that kind of thing.
Right. That's true.
Not this long after the originals.
Well, you know, it's not... Well, Alien, I can see the financial incentive. Blade Runner, I see no financial incentive because the original was a dud.
But now, even, obviously, it's infamous.
Now, but still,
I mean, yeah.
Okay, let's look at that, though. I mean, even now, because it is, we've talked about, very highly regarded, I don't know if there would be people dying to see this.
I don't either.
I don't really see this being a big deal.
But maybe it'll give us another, who knows, maybe it'll give us another science fiction classic. I mean, it's been a while since we've enjoyed one of those, you know?
Mm-hmm. True.
Who knows? But any excuse to get Rutger Hauer back on the show.
I've been waiting. I was telling someone about that last week, and I was like, yeah, we need him back, so this would be awesome.
Man, yeah, I haven't feared for my life in a while, so I think...
thank God he was across the Atlantic.
I want to break it back on. Yeah, he was in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Something tells me he wasn't smoking in some joint bar, marijuana bar. He seemed a little on edge.
Yeah.
Hey, Aaron, how you doing, man? Our home entertainment correspondent, Aranata Diaz, is on the phone.
Hey, guys, what's up?
Hey, what's up? You got a lot of great titles to talk about tonight.
Yeah, and I want to agree with what Gary was saying about the thing about Blade Runner. You know, it's a weird thing. You know, studios, they like to green light, you know, sequels or reboots to movies that have, quote-unquote, become classic. And studios are very smart. I mean, they crunch their numbers. They know. But it almost seems like they every once in a while they seem to maybe forget, or they get a little too excited, and that, yes, Blade Runner is a classic. It is a landmark. It has influenced films. And it did modestly well when it first came out. It didn't do what they thought it was going to do, but it did modestly well. But then it had this long shelf life. But the thing is, the audience for it now, even those who've caught up with it 25 years later, almost 30 years later, and say it's a masterpiece, that audience is still not, it's not Empire Strikes Back. I still think there are people who probably know of Blade Runner, but probably either haven't seen Blade Runner or, you know, are not rabid fans of Blade Runner. It's
I agree.
Certainly
yeah.
not a film that lends itself to constant repeat viewings like the original Matrix or the Star Wars films.
You know what, though? I guarantee you the reason why they thought the movie would do well when it first came out was because of Harrison Ford.
Oh, yeah. I would think that was a big part of it.
It was Harrison Ford, and it was Ridley Scott, who had a big hit with Alien. So they figured sci-fi, Harrison Ford, how can you not lose? How can you lose? And the thing is, what's interesting, you know, if you look at that summer of 82, the two bleaker sci-fi films of that summer were obviously Blade Runner and the John Carpenter's The Thing. And the hits, if you will, were obviously E.T., which overshadowed everything, came out of the field, and then Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which was this truly, which was a reboot, if you will, of the Star Trek movies, and had momentum and had a real sense of genre storytelling.
It was an audience movie. Blade Runner isn't an obvious an audience movie, which it's just the nature of the movie. It's
well, that brings
criticism
up, and I don't want to take away from the Criterion discussion, but I just want to say something. There's another movie that comes out at the end of the summer, actually, my God, almost 30 years ago, and that's The Road Warrior. And that's that's an issue. When it was looked like Mel Gibson might star in Fury Road, this was 2003, you know, the Warner Brothers crunched the numbers, and all three Mad Max movies made, like, what, it was $67 million all combined.
Yeah.
And now I know they're doing these two back-to-back 3D reboots or whatever you want to call them with, Tom Hardy. as Mad Max. I don't know if the, you know, and I think it's the same thing with Blade Runner. I don't know if there, I mean, people, there's a name recognition, obviously, of Mad Max, but I don't know if there is an, if there is a ticket buying recognition, though.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, Road Warrior is obviously the most iconic of the Mad Max films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a, you know, it's one of those weird things. It was a hit, but it was like one of these sleeper action hits, kind of like Terminator. And then, you know, the third Mad Max film, which is the one that they, you know, they greenlit because of the popularity that Mad Max, that Road Warrior got, it had the bigger budget. And actually it did do well, but it's one of those deals of possibly unreasonable expectations. Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome did well for a Mad Max movie, but apparently it didn't do well for what they thought it should have done.
That's a great point, Aaron.
The landscape has changed so much. If those performed the way they, if those were released now and performed the same as they did 20, 25 years ago, they'd be complete failures.
Just judging from this weekend, I mean, yeah, I mean, if they had those kind of numbers,
And expectations are not, expectations can be dangerous too.
Oh, they are.
I mean, there was no expectation for, I'm sure, the Road Warrior to perform as well as it did.
No, none at all. I mean, remember, Mad Max was shown on drive-ins in this country. We had a friend go up and see it in Delaware on a drive, in a drive-in.
It's a great drive-in movie.
Yeah, it's an awesome movie.
And also remember Mad Max, actually it didn't really do anything when it initially came out, and it wasn't until Road Warrior that it was re-released.
Yeah.
And also remember the original Mad Max, unlike Road Warrior, they dubbed Mel Gibson's
voice. You could tell immediately. I'll never forget. We went to go see it up the street. There's a theater up the street, and we went to see it. And it was, my mom was like, "My God, his voice is dubbed."
Right. Mm-hmm. And when they dubbed him, did they remove all the anti-Semitic dialogue?
No, that stayed intact.
Did it?
If you play the DVD backwards, it's all there.
That's right. Okay. Hey, we got some DVDs to talk about real quick, Aaron.
Yes, we do.
I got some criterions here.
Okay.
Real excited about, and you can chat about them as well.
Right.
Befitting of with our Stanley Kubrick series, ongoing series, Criterion, I mean, this isn't why they released it, because we're doing a series, but Criterion released Stanley Kubrick's 1956 film, The Killing, which is a great, great movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think his first truly great movie. And it's a beautiful picture. Mm-hmm. It's got this, I was watching it the other night. I mean, it's got a brief interview with James B. Harris,
mm-hmm.
which we talked to James B. Harris for about an hour and a half, and a lot of the information is the same. But what I particularly cherish in the set is a video interview with Sterling Hayden from like a 1980s French television show. This was a couple of years before he passed away. And I haven't read his autobiography. I haven't seen interviews with him before, so this was my first glimpse at him. And yeah, he was an old school, authentic guy, and my interest was piqued by watching this interview, so I started to read up on him, and I didn't realize his life story. I mean, I didn't realize that he was crushed by having names during McCarthyism,
mm-hmm.
something he really couldn't get over. It was a big regret for him. And
mm-hmm.
I'd like to investigate him more. I'd like to do a show on those older character actors that
mm-hmm.
everyone
yeah,
loves
I,
but aren't in the vernacular.
I interviewed a producer of the Criterion edition of The Killing, Curtis Cho, and I told him, and that interview will be airing soon on my show, but I told him that, to me, the highlight of this disc was the Sterling Hayden interview. It's just kind of remarkable. He's a real character. I love listening to him talk, and
mm-hmm.
like every third or fourth word, he just goes, hmm, hmm.
Okay.
No, he was great.
It's just classic. And he tells hilarious stories
mm-hmm.
out of school. I mean, he tells an anecdote about Joan Crawford that's just priceless, talking about Johnny Guitar, and it's astonishing
mm-hmm.
to to hear him say that he's not that big a fan of Johnny Guitar, which is a classic Butch lesbian western.
You're absolutely right, Aaron. Absolutely.
I mean, he's not too crazy about it, which is just kind of astonishing. So that truly is the highlight of the disc.
You know what, though? He's one of those authentic guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you could put Lee Marvin in this. You could put Mitchum in this.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We don't have anybody like that nowadays.
No, we don't. We don't.
And everybody's born going to therapy. So, I mean,
well,
we don't really...
Well, born going to therapy, but let me ask you guys something else. And if I'm repeating myself from a couple of years ago, forgive me. But does it seem like... It seems like one of the prerequisites of becoming an actor is to have six-pack abs.
I mean, that's why I got into it.
I know, that's why I got into it, too. But, I mean, but it just seems like... I think
because
Mitchum
I have
and Marvin
been,
would be... They must be laughing their asses off wherever they are looking at somebody.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everybody's kind of... I mean, we have great actors out there, but...
Oh, yes, we do.
There are a lot of pansies out there.
Yeah.
There's, like, really no authentic presences, an authentic, genuine presence, like a Mitchum or a Lee Marvin.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that just has to show up.
Yeah.
And it's there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Gravitas. Gravitas. That's what I'm talking about.
There you go.
Yeah. Anyway, that's lovely. That's a great supplement. And also, the DVD also comes with Killer's Kiss, like a remastered version of Killer's Kiss.
Oh, cool.
Kubrick's film prior to that.
Yeah, which is interesting in that it's not a great film, but it is good to have, and I think it's legacy more than, obviously, Kubrick's. An early Kubrick film, but its legacy more than something like Blast of Silence, it truly is a document of New York City life, street life, as a backdrop, and it's just kind of astonishing to see. It's you kind of don't even pay attention to the story sometimes. You're just looking at the backgrounds and looking at the these non extras walking around.
Right.
That thing's amazing.
He also has there's a little vignette in there about Jim Thompson, the writer whose most famous book was The Killer Inside Me.
But also this did the basis for The Getaway, The Grifters.
Right.
He wrote a lot of great novels.
My favorite Thompson movie based on his material, actually, that no one ever talks about, is a movie called After Dark, My Sweet.
That's a great movie, great book.
Yeah. But he was most happy with his collaborations with Kubrick. And it goes in detail in the disc about how unlikely their partnership was because they were two completely different people. Kubrick was kind of this New York beatnik, and Thompson was, you know, more along the lines of Sterling Hayden. He was kind of a rough and tumble.
Well, he was kind of just, by the time they worked together, you know, Kubrick was still in his 20s, and Thompson was late 50s, and he was kind of this southern courtly gentleman. And so it's kind of, you know, one of those deals where the two unlikely personalities, but they manage to mesh well.
Now, the segment that they do have on Thompson, a biographer on Thompson, Robert Polito, does it. We tried to get him for the first episode.
It's a great book, the Thompson biography. If you ever get a chance to read it, it's a wonderful book.
I tried to get him, and I can never get him to get back to me about that first episode of Kubrick. One thing that is missing from the set, which one of my favorite aspects of any disc, and it's missing from The Killing, is the commentary. I mean, I'd almost prefer the commentary over the video interviews. I mean, I definitely would. If they could have had Harris do the commentary instead. But one disc that does have the commentary is Lindsay Anderson's If.
That's a great movie.
Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah, Malcolm McDowell and film critic and historian David Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great because Malcolm McDowell, a great, energetic, he's a great talker and very fun to listen to. He talks about the behind-the-scenes goings-on and what it meant to his career and his relationship with the co-actors and director Lindsay Anderson, who he had a really close relationship with. Meanwhile, the film critic cuts in with, you know, setting the story in historically, setting it up historically, and some more behind the scenes anecdotes. That's a great commentary. It also comes with some behind the scenes stuff, some TV specials that they did at the time. What is this? I haven't seen everything on it. Thursday's Children, an Academy Award-winning documentary about a school for deaf children, directed by Lindsay Anderson and narrated by Richard Burton. I haven't looked at that yet. That comes in it, too.
And If, remember, was very controversial, but I remember it was originally rated X when it came out. Because of its, I guess, violent content.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Michael McDowell couldn't get away from that.
No, he couldn't.
It is one of those early archetype students versus the establishment kind of film.
Right.
It's still one of the best.
Themes that will be echoed later on in Rob Lowe's Class of 1984.
I was wondering, will they Criterion do Oh Lucky Man and Britannia Hospital as well?
I have no idea what I'm saying.
Okay.
What?
I
don't think so. I don't think they haven't announced it yet.
Okay, because that would be wonderful if they did that. I mean, those two, the flesh out, the whole trilogy of those films.
They've announced their November, and they got Rules of the Game on there, and 12
mm-hmm.
Angry Men, and Fanning Alexander, and Rushmore, and
Three Colors.
Three Colors trilogy, yeah.
I mean, November is kind of ridiculous when it comes. It's like the it's probably the best month of the year for Criterion. Pretty remarkable.
The most remarkable set the Criterion has out currently is one of my favorite movies, and I'm definitely not alone in this. The Battle of Algiers.
Oh, a great movie. Great.
Yeah.
No.
It's wonderful. It's a Blu-ray transfer, two discs, documentary on the making of the film, a documentary on whatever happened to the director, Pontecorvo, of that film. Pontecorvo, after Battle of Algiers, which is considered one of the great war films,
mm-hmm.
one of the great films about revolution, he made Burn.
That's right.
With Marlon Brando. And that was problematic.
How could it not be? That's a crazy movie.
But Brando always said that that's a role that was dear to his heart. That's a movie he actually cared about. I don't think he cared so much about it as he was doing it, though.
Oh, that's obvious.
What's interesting about Battle of Algiers, and it's on the disc of the directors who revere it. One of its the two, I guess, more mainstream films that owe a great deal to Battle of Algiers, obviously, is Oliver Stone's Salvador.
Mm-hmm, right. Good point.
And Soderbergh makes no qualms that it was a big influence on the way he filmed Traffic.
Right.
And so.
Well, and the movie is special because it feels completely like a documentary. I mean, it's shot in this grainy black and white newsreel, and it actually, Soderbergh talks about this, it actually came with a warning at the beginning, or a note at the beginning that said, please note that not 1 foot of film is newsreel footage, because people were so fooled into thinking this was genuine. And there's a lot of action in the film that, I don't know. It's impossible to figure out how they did it because there are
right.
bombs exploding so close to the extras in the film.
I mean, it is a great example. I mean, you know, cinema verite gets, rightly or wrongly, a lot of times rightly, gets kind of rap on the knuckles because it doesn't seem to play fair with the audience. It does seem to be kind of a trick, a gimmick. Battle of Algiers is one of those high watermarks where a stylistic choice suits the subject matter, and the subject matter dictates the style, and it's amazing how it applies to a variety of different subjects. And it's not just war. I mean, Larry Clark in Kids uses the same type of technique where, you know, a lot of audiences thought it was real, and obviously it's staged.
Right.
You know, and so it's one of those rare things where the style and the story are one and the same.
Right. So that's a great set. That would be the most highly recommended of current Criterion releases for me. Cul-de-sac.
I just want to ask, is there anything, because I have the DVD of that, is there anything different?
No, this is the Blu-ray
edition
of it. So if the one, I guess I could say the advantage, it does clear up some shelf space because...
Right.
It goes from, I guess, 4 discs to 2 discs here.
Mm-hmm.
So buy that if you want to more space to buy others as well. To fill. Yeah. Cul-de-sac. Roman Polanski.
Mm.
We all love Roman Polanski on the show.
Now, this is kind of a weird film. This is not a film that gets talked about. Even when Polanski enthusiasts talk about his 60s output or his, you know, his weird thrillers or whatever, you know, they talk about Repulsion or Knife in the Water. You don't get much talk of Cul-de-sac.
Donald Pleasance.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Pleasance and Francois Darlac, I'm mispronouncing, so sorry, stars a withdrawn couple whose isolated house is invaded by a rude, burly American gangster on the run. The three engage in role-playing games of sexual and emotional humiliation. Yeah, that sounds like a Polanski.
That sounds like Thursday night at the Polanski house.
Right. God bless the Polanski, man. And I want to have him on
again,
the show.
A you know a film that have themes and situations that he would constantly return to. I mean, you know, you look at Cul-de-sac and you can see Death and the Maiden, or Bitter Moon. You know, so.
Have they come out with Knife in the Water on Blu-ray? Criterion.
Blu-ray? I'm not sure. Blu-ray.
Okay.
I thought
because I do love that. I do love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Knife.
This includes a 2003 documentary that was shot probably the same time that they shot the Knife in the Water documentary that they used for that release. But it's a 2003 documentary on the making of Cul-de-sac that Polanski and the cinematographer and producer take part in. So if you're a Polanski fan, that's another great Criterion title for you. One more title on my end, Aaron, and then you can get to some of yours. This
I
haven't watched yet.
I'm assuming real quick that... Polanski's interview was filmed not in the States.
Anyway, this one's great. 2000. Let's see, what am I looking at? Secret Sunshine.
Yeah, what's that?
2007.
Mm-hmm.
A master of intensely emotional human dramas, director Lee Chang-dong, that's his name, is a luminary of contemporary Korean cinema, and his place on the international stage was cemented by this stirring and unpredictable work examining grief and deliverance. Cannes Best Actress winner comes from this film. Secret Sunshine, it's a great foreign title, a Korean film from 2007 that is now available on Blu-ray from Criterion.
If I'm not mistaken, his latest film, I think it's going to be at the New York Film Festival.
What's that? What is that called?
I don't remember. I do remember seeing his name on a list of directors. I could be mistaken with Toronto, but I thought I saw his name on the upcoming New York Film Festival.
Does it star Ray Don Chong?
No.
Hit director Lee Chang-dong's. You know what? I always thought it would be hysterical if Bono married Yoko Ono. That would be great. Okay.
Bono Ono.
What do you got? What do you got?
They would
Aaron?
Call each other Bono. They'd be known as Bono.
Yoko Ono Bono, yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe there was a lawsuit involved or something, or they went to court over something and they got an attorney that worked pro bono. Because he could tell people he works pro bono for Yoko Ono Bono. That would be great. Come on, guys. We got to write a comedy.
No, that was good. I like this. This is very funny.
I mean, that's like Airplane. Roger, Victor. All right.
I hope they never remake that.
Oh, it's coming.
Oh, I'm sure you're right.
Okay. Aaron, what do you got? What titles you got?
I got a couple more mainstream titles. Coming out on Tuesday is Win-Win. The latest by Tom McCarthy with Paul Giamatti and Amy Ryan.
That's a great movie. I like that movie.
The wrestling comedy, the uplifting wrestling comedy film. I liked it. I thought it was a vast improvement over The Visitor, which I was not crazy about. Tom McCarthy is a good writer-director. He's a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
He's terrific on The Wire, the fifth and final season of The Wire. So he's a great actor. He is slowly improving as a writer-director. So Win-Win is an improvement over The Visitor. He's still a little too quirky for my taste, but audience seem to appreciate it.
So what was your problem with the visitor?
Yeah, well, I'm just curious. What was? Because I mean, the visitor seems more straightforward than Win-Win.
The visitor
White
is a
guilt,
weird film.
Right?
It's a weird film to criticize in that there's nothing quote unquote wrong
mm-hmm.
with it performance wise. I find the film to be a little condescending. It's funny, the problems that some critics have been leveling against The Help recent weeks, which I do not agree with, those are the arguments that I would put towards The Visitor.
Okay.
I think
I can see that. I can actually see that. Okay.
The film is the whole conceit of the film, the narrative thrust of the film is basically a curmudgeon, grouchy white guy who, through the deportation of an innocent other, if you will, foreigner,
mm-hmm.
learns to loosen up and see that, you know, there's goodness in foreigners, basically. And the last scene, there are two scenes that are pretty egregious in The Visitor. One, there actually is a scene with the main actor.
Richard Jenkins?
Richard Jenkins, yes. He actually stands in the middle of an office and gives a monologue, a speech about how can you be so cruel. It's something straight out of a, you know, 1950s or even a early 80s do-gooder movie. He actually grandstands at, you know, at someone and gives a monologue that we're supposed to cheer. I couldn't believe that scene. And then the final scene is kind of, a lot of people find it very moving. I find it kind of shocking. Basically, if you want to get cynical, the final scene is basically about a white guy who learns rhythm and learns to get down and get funky.
Yeah, but wasn't White Men Can't Jump the same?
That was a better film, actually.
You don't have a problem with that one?
I have no problem with that.
You know what interests me? When a movie like The Help or something comes out and there's all this talk about the movie being not genuine or based on white guilt or any of that stuff. And I've said this on the show before, when The Blind Side came out, that was the same thing, same kind of reporting that went on about, you know, there's no talk of race really in this movie and we're supposed to completely ignore it. And, you know, this do-gooder white family that takes in this underprivileged African-American boy and, you know, and transforms him with their love and grace and that kind of thing. And they were very pessimistic about it. And then I heard Sandra Bullock say something that she said, you know, the person that I play in real life, she thought nothing of it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I think it says more about the people doing this reporting.
Right.
That they have to look for this kind of thing in a movie like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's probably the tragedy that we're looking for. Where's the racism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, yeah, I agree with that. I agree with both of you on that.
The problem is, though, that the writing in The Blind Side is very broad, and the construct of the narrative in The Blind Side is that this kid supposedly was falling through the cracks and he was homeless and no one was looking after him and this family had a generous heart and took him in and so forth. That is great, but the film betrays that early on in the movie when there's I don't know if the role got cut out or it wasn't completely written or it's on the cutting room floor. There's a character, brief character scene by Kim Dickens, a great actress, plays a teacher who sticks up for this kid at some of these teacher conferences, these teachers' meetings, and she starts talking about, hey, this kid can take the test. He knows how to take the test. So there is more than, it's not just this one family that's generous. There are other people who do care for this kid. Unfortunately, that storyline never has any follow-through.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even truthful to supposedly its own conceit. The thing about Help, which is... You know,
so you're saying the way to prevent them from saying that the movie's about a white family that saves the day is to add more white people that try to save the day?
I'm saying that if you set up a film one way but you betray it, and you betray your own setup,
mm-hmm.
You need to go back to the typewriter.
Well, there's a lot of people that help him. I mean, there's the coach, there's mm-hmm. There's the family, there's the college recruiters, they're the people that help him study.
The college recruitment scene is a very dicey scene because the only other significant African American character in the film is the college recruiter, and she is played as kind of this almost borderline villain who wants to take him away from this family. So when you're messing around with images like that in the casting, you have to take into consideration certain things. What
yeah.
separates The Help from a movie like The Blind Side, what makes The Help so amazing, is that the audience is allowed to identify with every character in the film, black or white.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these other do-gooder films, it's made very clear that racists, you know, the races are evil, you know, people, and you're supposed to look down upon them and see them as ugly people. What's complex about The Help is that even the racist character, particularly Bryce Dallas Howard, while obviously we don't approve of her, we understand her way of thinking. She actually thinks she's a liberal because she believes in separate but equal. So we understand
yeah.
her way of thinking, even though we don't approve of it. So even the quote-unquote the bad person is not a caricature. That's kind of
there's always the danger of this. I mean, I watched The Blind Side again just two nights ago. It was on cable. And I was watching, and I said, you know, I really like this movie. There's a goodness about this movie that
yeah.
I like.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a good heart. At the same time, then you fall into the trap of, you know, but how naive is it? But at the same time, if a movie, if it's coming from a place of goodness like that, and it projects that, then, I mean, it's more than likely to get me.
No, I agree with you, Jamie, on that. And you need a movie like that is important, especially when it was released, because, you know, you need movies like that. It's very important, I think.
But my complaint to The Blind Side, I mean, I can complain on the, you know, we're talking about more thorny issues about its depiction of race relations or lack
mm-hmm.
thereof in the film. But I can nitpick on just obvious stuff. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the scene where Michael and a little boy are in his truck rapping to Young MC's Bust a Move, that scene is just horrendous. come on. As a screenwriter, you can do better than that scene. That scene is just pathetic.
What if that's what they were doing the moment of their wreck?
You know, sometimes adhering to, you know, I don't care about if a film is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
This is obviously, films are fiction. I'm not talking about documentaries, but movies are fiction. So emotional truth, in my mind, trumps factual truth most of the time. So even if that was totally accurate, you know what? You need to change it. It's just not going to work. It's like, you know, in World Trade Center, there's that subplot involving the guy who drives across a couple of states to help because he sees it on TV.
Right.
I remember the story was he was driving a Porsche 911, and Oliver Stone.
The Michael
said,
Shannon character, or
yes,
yeah. You know,
okay. Michael Shannon in a Porsche 911. Wow.
And Oliver Stone said we can't have him drive a Porsche 911
mm-hmm.
on 911. It's
mm-hmm.
no one's going to buy that, and he's right. It would have been too on the nose.
Well, it's a pretty extraordinary subplot of that anyway, that he was afraid that
yeah.
people weren't going to buy just on its own merits.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
So you
would
have preferred that they've been in the truck listening to Xanadu.
I would have cut the scene.
All right. I'm just joshing you, man.
You're just pulling your middle leg. I mean.
Xanadu, you're really showing your egg on that.
No, that was the first song that came to mind. I don't know what that
really?
Says about me. But, yeah.
That's the first song.
Oh, God, now we're going to argue about the song.
I was trying to think of a ridiculous song, and that's what came to mind.
Let's go to the next film, please.
Well, the next film is Xanadu, Criterion, Xanadu.
On a lighter, but and we could end on this one. This is awesome. It just came out this past Tuesday on the 16th. Everyone's favorite film on Blu-ray, Big Lebowski.
Mm. Oh, wow. Oh, I didn't know that was a blue. Holy shit. Okay, what's on it?
Well, it's all the stuff in the previous disc, but also there's a couple of new things involving Jeff Bridges' photo album and an interview with the actual dude himself, Jeff Dowd. So there's some really good stuff on there. It's a fun thing. But beside the point, Lebowski's on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Well, that's all I need to know. That I might have to call us. Yeah.
That's not like just our opinion, man. Like, it's really on Blu-ray.
So, yeah.
It's great.
So
Lebowski on Blu-ray. Funny movie.
No, it's
and it's one of these films. I wonder how long before Jeff Bridges actually does get tired of every year having to decline Lebowski Fest invites. I mean, he's done a couple, but you know,
he did it this year.
Yeah, he did it this year for the Blu-ray. You know,
and
when,
his album. I wonder how many times his publicist is going to get tired of declining us. That's the one that never got back to me. Like, throughout the years, she would never write me back. And so, finally, I told that to the person that keeps his website. And so she had the courtesy to get back to me with a no, instead of just ignoring me.
Right.
Well, there you go.
He needs to get a new publicist. So we can finally get him on the show.
He seems to be doing fine.
I know. Yeah, he's doing okay.
The thing is, and what's interesting is that his album is getting good reviews. Unlike most, you know, thespians who put out their, you know, their record and it's kind of a vanity thing. This is supposedly a top flight album.
Yeah.
I want to hear this David Lynch album that comes out soon.
Really?
I'm curious. Curious, dude. I'm just really fucking curious.
Why not? I mean, his movies are known for their completely immersive soundscapes. Why wouldn't he be good recording?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very curious. I'm not saying it's gonna be. It could be great or anything, but I'm just very curious to hear it. I mean,
It's been 10 years since Mulholland Drive. I would just love to get a semi-coherent narrative film out of the guy.
Yeah. I think he might have lost his passion for filmmaking. But you know what? We're talking about movies that didn't do well when they first came out, and if they made a sequel or they returned to them, does that necessarily secure a large audience just because it's grown in reputation over the years? And Lebowski is one.
Mm-hmm.
Lebowski didn't do great when it came out.
No, it didn't. It actually sort of died that weekend, if I'm not mistaken.
And not only that, but I mean, it was one of those. It was a late January, early February release, which obviously, 13 years later, you know, that's not the dumping ground it used to be. I mean, it's still, you're not going to release Star Wars during
But. It came out with the same weekend as Twilight, not the Twilight Vampires, but Twilight and was it U.S. Marshals? It came out the same weekend.
Yeah. I mean, the landscape has changed. Now, you know, there are films in the, you know, there are certain types of films that do big in that first quarter. But a sequel to Lebowski, see, that's the thing. I think Lebowski is one of those deals. It is a cult film. Mm. It is a popular film. I think a sequel would obviously do better than the original.
I think it would do really well.
It would do well, but once again, it's one of those deals of reasonable expectations. I mean, if they were to do it expecting True Grit numbers, not so much. If they were expecting Oh Brother, Where Art Thou numbers.
Or Serious Man numbers.
Yeah. I think it would do Oh Brother, Where Art Thou numbers, which is like, I think, 40 million at the time, which is
big deal for them.
I think it would do more than that.
I think it would do 60-70.
Yeah, I think enough people consider that movie a religion that they would keep going back.
Oh yeah, the repeat viewings on that.
That's the other thing. It'd have to be good.
Right. It does, and you know they're not interested in making a sequel anyway. But what great thing a return of the dude to the big screen would be.
I guess, and the thing is, that I don't see where that's one of the things about Lebowski is that the story kind of ends where it begins,
right?
And he doesn't really go anywhere. So a sequel would kind of be a repeat of that, because the whole beauty of Lebowski is that he is stuck and he does not move forward.
Right.
Got to be better than Tron Legacy.
Which they're doing a third one.
Yeah.
Tron
Less
Unbound
that.
Or whatever. I don't know.
So wait, what's the third one going to be? Wait, what's the... I mean, she's out. She gets to see the sunrise or whatever. What the hell else do they need to say? I mean,
they
know.
Announced that third Tron, like, right the opening weekend of the Tron Legacy. I guess they were impressed enough by the performance to set up a third
really?
One.
Okay, wow.
That was a beautiful. She sees a beautiful sunrise. Granted, it's during a bad ozone day.
Yeah,
in
I know. But I mean, what else do you need to say? She got to see the sunrise. Okay. And what more do we need to know about Tron? I mean,
well, it's kind of like I guess the Matrix films. You know, when Neo got out, the world kind of went. You know, the outside world and the inside world kind of started meshing. So maybe there'll be a disc fight. You know, on the 405 or a motorcycle. That'd
right,
be kind of
okay.
cool. A motorcycle chase on the 405 would be kind of badass. You know, but. You know, who knows? As long as we get more Daft Punk. Daft Punk.
Hey, we got a 207 area code on the line. I'm picking
say
up.
That
hello?
With enthusiasm.
207, you're on the line.
Hello, where's Heather Langenkamp?
Heather Langenkamp was on in the first 45 minutes of the show.
Oh, bye.
You know, Jamie, I don't know why you bother sometimes with the. It's almost like when Dennis Miller would take calls on Dennis Miller Live. It's like,
oh, that's yeah. right. Yeah.
I didn't know 10-year-olds listened to the show. Actually, but
that's awesome, dude. That's awesome. That's a great.
Well,
that's
and apparently,
10-year-olds
walked the original Elm Street.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Anything else going on? So The Help and Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the number one and two spot in the box office for the weekend, fending off the other new releases. Jerry, did you see Fright Night?
Yes, I did. I didn't mind Fright Night. I honestly didn't mind it. I mean, cause it was decent.
Did you see 2D or 3D?
I saw 2D. I didn't really see a need to see it in 3D. I mean, did I miss anything for anyone who saw it in 3D?
I don't know. I just heard, I mean, I would... I'm going to try to see it this week.
Mm-hmm. It's not a bad film.
I'm going to see it in 2D. I give them points that it was actually filmed in 3D as opposed to a conversion. But this was kind of a bloodbath when it came to, I guess, three 3D movies in one weekend.
What's up with that? I mean, why would you do that? And plus,
I think it was a case of...
too, still, so. And Glee.
I think it was a case of each
Glee.
One of those studios had already picked their date, and neither, none of them were going to flink. And also, I think they thought that they were going to be three separate audiences. And to a certain extent, they are, although I'm sure there's overlap between Fright Night and Conan.
I would think so. I mean,
but obviously the Spy Kids film was a totally separate audience. So I figured they thought they were just going to get the family market.
And Glee tanked.
Oh, Glee? They say killed the concert film.
I'm not a fan of Glee, but there are a lot of people out there that are. I mean,
they didn't go see it.
But that's the thing, though.
Or maybe
tanked.
No one else went to go see it besides those people. Maybe that was
the
problem.
I mean, Fox is smart. They knew what they were doing. When the movie was announced, I originally thought, well, it'll do fine. And I would hear people say, oh, the Glee concert is going to be spectacular. And I was like, why would – the other thing, you know, I don't know why people assume that the TV to film transfer is just going to automatically guarantee, $100 million kind of thing. I mean, the Glee audience is only about – it's a phenomenon. But the thing that keeps the Glee audience, it's not the show. I mean, the show does fine, but it's the music, you know,
right.
iTunes downloads, and so forth. So you know, I'd probably venture wager that the soundtrack to the Glee concert film probably did better.
I would guess they were taking a cue from the Justin Bieber 3D concert movie that did really well. Didn't that become the top grossing concert movie of all time, or number two or something? I mean,
I think it was two or three. I think Hannah Montana is still.
Wow, really? Hannah Montana?
I think that one is still.
We're living through the apocalypse. That's all I have to say.
No, I don't think we're. I think we're in the aftermath, dude. We just don't know it.
Well, I mean,
this is the afterlife, really?
Yeah. Glee is a fun show. I don't watch every episode. I've watched a couple episodes. I think it's fine, but you know, I don't see why you would think that would. You know, like you said, Aaron, I think it's the downloads from iTunes, really. That's.
It's like people who thought the Star Wars Clone Wars cartoon movie. Oh, well, it's Star Wars. It's going to do 100 million. It's like, no, it's not. The show is on Cartoon Network.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
so,
right.
You know, it's you can't just throw Star Wars on anything and expect 100 million. If that was the case, and Lucas is super smart about this, if that was the case, he would have released the Ewok movies in the theaters.
See, and I think that 24 could be a good film if they made
that
into a film.
That has the, you know, it's the exceptions, not the rule. I mean, the exceptions are movies like The Fugitive, which take the premise of obviously a beloved show, but you know, they translate it into its own film thing, and it goes on its own stratosphere. And I think 24 is ripe for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think
the one that I don't think is Entourage, because Entourage, they're talking about a feature film of it, mm-hmm. or wanting to do it. Entourage is a weird thing because the show is lightweight, like majorly lightweight. When the show isn't good, it tries to bring more depth to it. When the show works at its best, it riffs on the camaraderie between the guys, and that's all it's about.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't complicate things very much at all.
I'll go see it, Jamie.
I don't think there's a movie waiting to be made here. I mean,
I'll go see the Entourage movie. Entourage fan. But the thing is, the mistake that I think people are making is thinking that the popularity of Entourage is equal to that of Sex and the City, and it isn't.
At all. You're right. Yeah.
Sex and the City was a true phenomenon.
Moment. Sex and the City, honestly, isn't, you know, it's not reaching for me. I mean, I'm not the demographic.
I'm not the demographic either, but I mean, the popularity of Sex and the City and its cultural impact is far greater than Entourage.
It's serving an audience that starved for entertainment just for them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's serving an audience that's used to taking their children to G-rated Pixar, you know.
Or seeing any rom-com that comes out and hoping that one hits out of every, you know, half dozen. You know, there's no shortage of movies about guys hanging out.
Yeah, and I don't see this one. I mean, what are Entourage's weekly numbers? I mean...
Not great. I mean,
they're
under 2 million.
Can I say, I think the show jumped the shark a while ago too. I don't think it's something that, I mean, I think the first two or three seasons are really good, but even having said that, I don't think there's a movie there.
It's a weird show. I mean, the more shallow it is, the better it is.
Yeah, and they are.
But still, it still feels like kind of like the palate cleanser, like, you know, like the sherbet or whatever they give you between meals at a fine restaurant. It feels like that in between The Sopranos and True Blood. You know,
mm-hmm.
here's a little something to cleanse your palate. You know.
Well, I only think Entourage only had one truly weak season. I've always enjoyed it, but the thing, unlike, and the numbers are, you know, minimal. But the thing, that's the thing about all, you know, paid cable shows. The numbers. Initially are minimal. I mean, Sex and the City was, I think, maybe at its peak 4 or 5 million. But the thing is, Sex and the City, it took off when it went to TBS,
mm-hmm.
And it just grew and grew with syndication. Same thing with Sopranos and The Wire, with those shows and syndications. That's where those shows' popularity has truly, truly grown.
Mm-hmm.
And Entourage,
well, the, the basic cable or the cable stations, I mean, True Blood is like a huge hit for them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's an audience of 6 million. It's a huge hit for them. On
right.
network television, we're talking of a hit being, you know, 12, 14 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a,
right.
it's a different criteria.
Yeah. Totally.
Criteria.
It's a different criteria. And the thing is, different criteria. And the thing about syndication, particularly with some of these shows, you know, Sex and the City went to TBS, Sopranos went to A&E, you know, Entourage went to Spike. And frankly, the Spike network is not as established a brand as A&E or TBS.
Right.
So
yeah.
It's just one of those two. I mean, if they keep the budget low on an Entourage, I mean, if they treat it like an indie film and do it for, you know, 15, 20 million at the most, it'll do fine. I mean, they
yeah.
shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
They, if they're expecting it to do what the first Sex and the City did,
they're out of their minds.
Yeah, and I don't. And I think they know that. I don't. I think they know it's not going to do the original Sex and the City.
And plus, some of these shows. I mean, Entourage is different because it's serialized. I mean, it's an individual story. Every kind of episode. It's not so serialized. But some of these shows. Why should they make them into movies? I mean, True Blood is allowed the breadth of a full run series.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it lets the story breathe. It wouldn't work as well as a feature film.
Right.
Any kind of individual story out of that, I don't think.
Yeah, and it's the thing about genre pieces like that. You know, each season is kind of its own 13-hour movie. What I would
right.
I would love HBO to do, but they'll never do it because it's a stain on their reputation. Would be nice if they were to actually say, okay, we're going to go ahead and we're going to do those last two Deadwood TV movies and
yeah.
wrap that up, but they won't
yeah.
do that.
I mean, I can see Boardwalk Empire being a great 2-hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's just taking directs it.
Yeah, Scorsese will be back to direct the season finale on the second season coming.
Oh, cool!
Okay.
All right,
that's awesome.
Yeah,
yeah. He
needs
to get off his butt and do Irishman. I say that with the utmost respect because I desperately want him for the Kubrick series.
You know, it's just cable shows are just different. I mean, Mad Men only has, I think, 2-4 million viewers, but I mean, its cultural impact is just you can't qualify it.
And meanwhile, let's see what happens to The Walking Dead now that Darabont's out. You know, how much
that really shocked me. That really caught me off guard.
I think it shocked him too.
I mean, I'm sure. But
Darabont has a reputation of being very, very passionate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what was the rationale? What was the reason that this happened?
He was ticked, apparently. He was, first and foremost, completely ticked off that they were slashing the budget like they did. They're slashing the budget on a show that is their top show.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't giving them the support they felt that they needed, and it was sacrificing the content, the budgetary limitations. So I guess Darabont was too vocal and combative on that issue, and so they just got rid of him.
Oh,
that's what Hollywood
mistake.
Reporter.
Big mistake.
That's Hollywood
so
Reporter. And it's in a story reported by Kim Masters, who I take everything she writes with a grain of salt. She's kind of known for these kind of aggressive hatchet jobs.
Well, I mean, this comes from Darabont himself, too. I mean, Darabont, before he was canned,
mm-hmm.
came out and was really vocal about his displeasure with the budget.
Yeah, and the problem is, and I understand his displeasure, and he might not even have a point. The problem is, though, you know, because the unspoken thing that the other showrunners are complaining is that AMC gives preferential treatment to Matt Weiner and Mad Men.
Right.
And the thing is, and whether this is fair or not, it's just the way it is. Mad Men, like The Sopranos on HBO. Made the network, took
mm-hmm.
the network into a whole new stratosphere.
That's
so
true.
They, you know, they came first, and so they are going to get preferential treatment. And that's just the way It is. Other shows came after Sopranos that were just as good, Deadwood, The Wire in particular. But, you know, they had to, you know, they weren't going to get Sopranos type lavishment. And the same thing with Mad Men. You know, The Killing, Rubicon, Breaking Bad, and now Walking Dead. Great shows, even though Rubicon got canceled, great shows, but, you know, they're not going to get the lavishment that Mad Men got. And the fact is, Mad Men, when its negotiations, they actually had to, I think one of the concessions was, is to cut their shows, cut 2 minutes out of their episodes. So I think they went from 44 minutes to 42 to 41 minutes. So, I mean, even that show had to kind of, you know, play ball a little.
Yeah.
Okay. If anyone's missed any portion of the Heather Langenkamp interview, you can. The show will be available for replay a few minutes after we get done tonight. Her interview begins about the 15-minute mark and continues until about the 40-minute mark. Go to IamNancy.net to pick up her new documentary titled I Am Nancy. Join us on Facebook. Movie Geeks United has their own fan page there. Look us up and like us. Please like us.
Please
and
love
then,
us.
That's right. And then Twitter, Movie Geeks Unite on Twitter. That's where you can get some new show updates, as well as our website at moviegeeksunited.net. Guys, thank
Why
you.
Why does Movie Geeks Unite on Twitter? Not
it, it doesn't allow me the D. I mean, that's too many letters. One too many letters. Yeah.
How many letters
Isn't that a pisser? How many letters is it? I don't know. Why don't you count it when we're done?
Five.
I don't know.
15 letters. I guess you only allowed 15 letters?
Only 15. Oh, dear. No.
I guess so. Okay. What do you want to end? I'll give you a choice, Jerry.
Okay.
Pick the number 9 or the number 25.
I'm going to go with 25.
Okay. We close the show with one of my all-time favorite film scores. Terrence Blanchard's theme from Spike Lee's The 25th Hour.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
Yeah. The other one was 9.5 weeks. So if you'd chosen 9,
either
that's
way,
what you would
have
gotten.
Said the same thing. I mean, so.
Yeah. Well, 9.5 weeks, that's, you know, I love that movie.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, guys. Thank you for joining us out there in the listening audience. And thank you guys, Jerry and Aaron, for joining me.
Thank you. It was a great time.
That'll be cool, man.
All right, dude.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night.